All right, so we have a number of really interesting clues. First of all, Rachel and Jacob were setting out from and pulled away from Bethel, the home and family of God, just as the self-proclaimed apostle of Christianity would pull the world away from the household of God and would oppose the covenant, which is the home and household of God, the family of God. And then it says it came to exist now and would repeat after a duration of time, owed. We're speaking of now and then, of now, of the Benjamin being conceived and then the ultimate consequence, the ultimate Benjamite, the most infamous Benjamite of all time in Paul. When they were at a particular distance from God, Kibroth, creating a distant multitude by intertwining. Now, Christianity, when that's, you know, I used to be a Christian, so it pains me to have to say this, but Christianity is syncretized. It is a blend of all of the pagan myths that came before, based primarily on the Babylonian myths, and then with other, particularly Grecian myths blended in. But everything in Christianity has been an amalgamation of the pagan belief systems of the people that the Roman Catholic Church in particular wanted to gain mastery over. And what they figured is that rather than trying to convert the masses to their new religion, they would just convert their new religion to appeal to the masses. So the Christian Jesus is modeled after Dionysus. The Christian philosophy is modeled after Gnosticism. Christmas holidays, Sunday, Easter, Christmas, are all modeled after Ishtar, the Queen of Heaven and the Mother of God. The Trinity is Babylonian. Mm-hmm. You know, every aspect of it, everything of it, is an amalgamation of pagan doctrines, all intertwined. So when you talk about an intertwined religion, the most intertwined religion of all time,
if you take all these pagan things away, they ain't got nothing left.
There is nothing left of it.
There's no power in it.
No, there isn't. And so it's also an implement used to strain out rocks from the grain. But do you know of an individual that was referred to as a rock? I know two.
Oh, yeah.
That are really important rocks. Who are the two important rocks that that Paul? That is correct. He was the rock of our salvation. And what did
as a stone?
The person that Shaul calls out by name to personally condemn is Shimon Kephish. In fact, he even calls him by the Kephish title, which means rock. And his whole idea was to strain out Shimon Kephish's, Peter's influence. So, when they were a certain distance away, we're talking about the Benjamite here that would strain out the two rocks, the rock of our salvation, Yosha, who he never once quoted accurately, only attempted to quote once and misquoted him regarding the covenant, and Shimon Kephish, who is the person that he was most at war with during his career. So, another clue. Now, by the way, you're free to say we're reading too much into this.
No, I don't think we are.
But doing
the research, you find that, that's exactly what it says if you read it.
Yes, and I agree with you. And the my retort would be, yes, that's what it actually says. My retort would also be that the author of this is a lot smarter than any of us, and therefore was able to communicate at many levels. So the author of this was able to convey a message that would be instructive to those who heard it, meaningful to those who heard it, 3,500 years ago, and be instructive and accurate to those who are reading it today. And the only thing that is instructive and enlightening today is what all this points to. And that's why I think you'd be foolish not to consider these connections.
Mm-hmm.
So let's continue with them. It says, the land they were approaching and entering was Ephratah. So they had left the home of God, and they were headed towards and now approaching and entering Ephratah.
Yeah.
It is the singular of Ephraim.
Mm-hmm.
Ephraim was the tribe most supportive of and loyal to Shaul,
yeah.
Which was angered when the royal prerogative was transferred from Yehuda. It's also the name given to the northern kingdom, which was in rebellion with Yehuda, prior to being depopulated and destroyed by the Assyrians.
Mm-hmm.
It is from Ephah, worthless and for naught. Can you say lowly and little? Ephah.
Not a stretch. I'm
sorry. To surround and to confine, binding. Can you say religion? And Ephah, a viper and a venomous snake. Can you say Satan?
Now, back up a minute. What's Latin for religion?
It means to religion, which means to rebind.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This is a satanic, demonic religion that is opposed to Yehuda and Yehudim, the place and the people, which is aligned with the northern kingdom that was in rebellion and ultimately was depopulated and destroyed because of the rebellion. And then Rachel is one of Jacob's wives. It means sleeping sheep who move away. Went into labor, and she gave birth. But in her labor and childbirth, she experienced great distress and opposition. Kasha. She encountered a cruel and confusing stubbornness, an unyielding and corrupt resistance, a complete lack of humility, manifesting a superior attitude, one who would be confrontational and brutal, causing great hardship and trouble, a difficult and perplexing force that was obstinate, burdensome, and genuinely bad.
That's a lot to say about a baby, even if you're having difficulty in childbirth. That's there for a reason. You could have said she was having a lot of difficulty with the child.
Yeah.
Giving birth to this child. You just wouldn't go there.
Right.
If it wasn't significant to tell you something.
Yeah, you wouldn't use a word that means opposition, for example.
No.
The child is not opposed to the mother. It's not opposed to birth. But this child was in opposition. Opposition to God, of course.
To life.
Right. This child admitted that he was cruel and vicious. When Shimon Kefesh wrote of him, he said he was confusing. He was unyielding. He was corrupt. His resistance to God was based on corruption. He had an absolute lack of humility. Paul's ego is manifest all the way through his writing. In fact, in 2 Corinthians, he says, you know, someone reading this, you know, would look at the greatness of my revelations and an oratory, and they would say, you know, I'm deserving of the ego that I'm manifesting. But, you know, to keep me in check, Satan has demon-possessed me. Yeah, it's... He's a special guy when it comes to conceit. So he was indeed a perplexing force that was obstinate. Now, written in the peel imperfect, the object, Rachel's son, suffers the ongoing and unfolding effect of the verb, making Benjamin stubborn and confrontational, unyielding in his resistance and opposition, confusing, corrupting, arrogant, troubling, perplexing, burdensome, and bad throughout time. She knew him. She was inspired to know him.
Most of all, that looking it up, too, is severe, fierce, stubborn, suffering. Yeah, severe suffering, yeah.
So when he became stubborn and unyielding in confusing, confrontational, and obstinate opposition, this is Ba-Kasha again, with distressing resistance, with a superior attitude of arrogance, manifesting a perplexing corruption during labor and childbirth. She said to the one helping her give birth, the midwife, "You should choose never to respect this one, because there is another son for you."
Isn't that the metaphor for the birth of Christianity?
Yeah. You should never respect this one, because there's another son for you. Rather than you should never respect the Benjamite, Paul, there's another son for you, Yosha.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's saying. Don't respect the Benjamite. Respect Yosha. There's another son for you. Don't respect this one. And how could God be any clearer? Yeah. Don't respect the Benjamite. There is another son for you. A different son for you. Yosha. Yeah, absolutely. This is the choice between Paul and Yosha. And Thomas Jefferson, pretty smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote that Paul was the first to corrupt the message of Yosha. He was the leader of the chorus corrupting his message. Thomas Jefferson recognized it.
Yeah, I've seen his Bible. He tore out most of Paul's writings.
He tore out everything except Yosha's. He tore out all of Paul's writings.
Right.
All of Paul's letters.
Paul,
he completely eliminated
them. Also.
Yeah. He only retained Yosha's words. That's, by the way, the only part of it that I care about. The only part of it that I'll read. The only part of it I consider. Only part of it I'll consider is Yosha's words. He did the same thing that I would do. So he is predicting not only the birth of Christianity, but the fact that while Christians believe that their religion is based on their Jesus, the fact is it isn't based on Paul. They ignore everything Yosha said, which is to be Torah observant, to never undermine, never neglect the Torah. Don't ever think that he came to annul the Torah. They completely ignore and disrespect the words of Yosha. They do not follow him in his observance of Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, and Shavuot. They reject those things. They don't honor the Sabbath as he did. They instead respect Paul. And they believe what Paul said. So Christianity, its heart, is a complete rejection of the Son that matters, Yosha, and a complete reverence for and respect for the Benjamite.
I don't believe most Christians can deal with that information. You're absolutely right. They can't process that.
They can't process it. But it is the simplest way for a rational person to get them to reject Christianity,
how do you ignore that?
Yeah, you cannot be a follower of Yosha unless you are Torah observant. He was Torah observant. If you're going to follow him, you must be Torah observant. And if you are Torah observant, then you cannot be a Christian.
Well, isn't that the old saying? What would Yosha do?
Yeah, he would follow the Torah, and and he did.
And he did.
Right.
He told everybody else to, too.
Paul's famous way of saying things was to say, "But I, Paul, say."
Yes.
How many times did he say, "But I, Yosha said"?
Never.
No. He attempted one time to quote him, you know, in 13 letters. He attempted one quotation, and he did exactly the same thing with Yosha's citation of the covenant that he did every time he attempted to quote Yahweh.
Now, think about that.
First, he took him out of context,
mm-hmm.
which is the only means to understanding.
Right.
Then he only quoted a small part of a sentence, and he eliminated the portions even of the phrase that he was conveying so that it could be interpreted to mean the opposite of what was actually being said. And that's the one quote that he has of Yosha. Took it out of context, only quoted a small fraction of it, removed a bunch of words, even in the clause that he was citing, to draw things together that were actually separated. And he only did that one time. So think for a moment the stupidity of thinking that Paul was called by Yosha to speak and write on his account. When he only quoted him once, and the one time he quoted him, he misquoted him. You know, the one thing that he quotes correctly is the first time he claims that he sees Yosha, he says, it's difficult to kick against the goad. That's Dionysus' most famous line, accurately quoted from the Baccalaureate.
Right.
So he gets Dionysus quoted correctly.
Yeah, that one.
But,
aren't you proud? Rachel would be so proud.
Oh, Rachel is saying, I told you so.
I hate this guy.
I told you so. Wow, so when he became stubborn, unyielding, and confusing, confrontational, and an obstinate opposition, with distressing resistance and a superior attitude of arrogance, manifesting perplexing corruption and being a tremendously painful burden during labor and childbirth, she said to the one helping her give birth, you should choose never, this is al yare, never to respect, revere, or honor, choosing never to afford a high status or authority to this one, because indeed another son is for you. And it was with her soul coming out that indeed she was dying. What does Yahweh call Shaul? Calls him out by name 666 years exactly before Paul would write his first letter, the one to the Galatians. What did he say of Shaul? That he was the plague of what?
Plague of death.
Plague of death. So, Benjamin's mother is immediately killed.
Symbolically, yeah.
Yeah. She dies as a result of this boy who would later become Benjamin.
He's tainted with death.
He's literally born in death.
Out of death, yeah.
Yeah, born out of death. His birth caused his mother to die. His birth has caused billions upon billions to die. He is the plague of death. That as she was dying, she called out his name, Ben-Oni, my son of unrighteousness, my son of idolatry, my son of iniquity, my son who exerts himself in vain. From O-N, egotistical and failed, evil and wicked, unjust, false, arrogant, and troublesome. Is there a better descriptive phrase for Shaul, the self-appointed Apostle Paul, than Oni, unrighteousness,
no, that's exactly.
Idolatry, iniquity, wicked, unjust, false, arrogant, and troublesome? Egotistical, failed, vain.
He mentions every one of those things in all his letters.
You betcha.
He confesses in all of his
Correct.
Letters. I mean, his letters are confessions to anyone
Correct.
Paying attention.
Correct. Yeah, he says that he was uncontrollably vicious. He said he was a sexual pervert.
Mm-hmm.
He admits to being insane. He admits to being duplicitous, to pretending to be things he wasn't to gain control over people. He admits to being demon-possessed.
Now, who represents God throughout the Torah who says they're demon-possessed? I mean, what do you relate that to?
Why don't you tell me somebody who is speaking for God who is insane? Now, God chooses people who are flawed. Now, he does so for two reasons, really. I'm going to go three reasons.
Okay.
The first reason he chooses people that are flawed is because when it comes to his name, you know, there's this this myth that his name is too righteous to mispronounce and that we shouldn't pronounce it over respect for him. And that unless you're going to...
From Rabbi's point of view.
Yeah, so from Yahweh's point of view, the person that he chose to introduce us to his name, to speak his name to the world... Had a speech in impediment, Moshe. So, you know, God is telling you right there, you know, do your best with it. You're not going
to
impress me with
Give
your diction.
Shot,
yeah, it's not going to do it. You're not going to offend me with your diction. If I'm not offended by a guy with a speech impediment saying my name, trust me, I'm not going to be offended if you mispronounce it.
Yeah.
And the person that he taught us, that really he chose to reveal the most important insights as to how to observe the Torah and how to be considered right with God, undermines the whole myth of Pauline Christianity, that if you break any of the Torah's laws, that you're guilty of all of them, and therefore you will be condemned. Didn't Dode break about all of them?
I'm just about. I mean, thank you, got everyone.
So wasn't the flaws of Dode perfectly suited to convey the benefits of properly observing the Torah and being right with God?
Yes, there is a way. Perfect. There is a way to walk to become tzedek.
Right, right. So flaws, God communicating through imperfect people, he does this specifically for the purpose of sending a message. For example, I never realized why the issue was with Jeremiah, was Jeremiah says, I'm way too young for this. Choose somebody. I'm way too young for this. Well, his story is the oldest story there is to tell. His story is the one that would not be manifest, would not play out before our eyes for another. Well, it would be 6 centuries. The world would grow old before what Jeremiah was telling us about, because Jeremiah speaks about Christianity. His audience was the Gentiles, and he's exposing and condemning Christianity. And so he chose someone who was young to oppose the elders of the church. All the way through, God chooses that. So that's one reason. The second reason is obvious. If God didn't choose to work through flawed people, there'd be no one.
Who are you going to work through?
Yeah, who's going to work through? The next reason is that the people who are flawed and know they're flawed.
Yes.
Are easy for God to work through, because we admit we're flawed and we just get out of the way and say we're irrelevant. We've got nothing going for us that should be of any interest to you. Knowing who we are, where we came from, is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing our credentials is irrelevant. Our credentials are irrelevant. If you're flawed and you know it, then you not only get out of the way, but you get really excited when Yahweh was able, with a dull and dented implement, to reveal something worthwhile.
Yeah.
And I think the next reason is that in reality, and this is really akin to the last one, that when pearls of great insight are presented by someone who has nothing going for them that would impress anybody, then maybe there's a few people that might say, well, how did that come about if the inspiration didn't come from somebody who's really smart? Because this dude, he ain't.
Yeah, you kind of expect Einstein to come up with a good theory.
Yeah.
You don't expect a whole lot out of me.
That's correct. There would be no reason for anyone to turn to us for insights into who we do. God, we don't have any credentials. But when we are providing more of them, more insightfully, more convincingly, more correctly than anyone else, that tells us that our source is extraordinary.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. The source is extraordinary. Yeah. So this individual is the antithesis of that, egotistical and vain, failed, false, unjust. But then his father summoned him. Doesn't give any reason. Father didn't listen to his dead wife's last confession.
No.
Just said, no, I'm going to summon him as Benjamin. But, you know, that's all right. Because Benjamin adds something to it.
Mm-hmm.
The one going south.
Right.
Towards the Sea of Gentiles. It's just another layer of information. All pretty powerful stuff that we learn simply by taking the time. Now, let's just look at these names here. In order, we have Benjamin, son headed south to the Sea of Gentiles. Cush, the one who was crooked, luring others into a trap. Abiel, whose father was El, the Canaanite god. Tesur, who besieges and binds as an adversary by prescribing drugs. Bekorath, who was the first to cry and complain, lamenting the birthright. And Aphak, the one who breathes, whose breath breaks and ensnares inflaming souls.
Yeah, words.
Yeah. Isn't that powerful?
Well, that's just a cursory look I did the first time around. I went, my gosh.
Yeah, so I don't know if any of this applied to King Saul.
Maybe a tiny little bit.
But all.
You are influenced by your relatives, especially your father, but not to the point. That wasn't written for him.
No, it all applies to the self-proclaimed Apostle Paul.
Yeah. Yeah.
The author of half the Christian New Testament devoted himself to Gentiles, claiming exclusive authority over them. He was crooked by his own admission, pretending to be whatever gave him an advantage over those that he sought to entrap. His El God was the Lord, a nameless deity that was known by these two titles, God and Lord. But there was another title, Christ, based upon the Greek chryso, which speaks of the application of drugs. Paul even admitted to being possessed by a representative of Satan, making him adversarial. Moreover, his twisted thesis required Yehudim forfeiting their birthright to the covenant so that he could style a new one by breaking the old one.
That should make them running out of the aisles to hear that.
You'd think so. If you were a Christian, you should be.
I know. It's another wow.
Yeah. The next line may apply to both men, even to their fathers. He was an individual going south. Note that Shaul ventured out of Tarsus, which was due north of Yisrael, veering toward the Sea of the Gentiles, also true with Paul. Both came from wealth, but it was Paul who bragged about his physical ability to cause suffering and his religious and political prowess as a result of his rabbinic schooling. In fact, he bragged that he was second to none in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, the disciple Shimon, Peter, specifically accused Paul of circular reasoning, saying that his letters caused the unwary to suffer. Twisting the Torah to suit his agenda was Paul's specialty. He was a master at it, which is why I suspect is the reason he has been able to bamboozle so many souls. He was good at twisting something that people don't know very well. In fact, that's the thing that, as we turn to Proverbs 6, God's going to speak about why he thinks that Paul and Christianity are an abomination, why he hates Paul and Christianity. And after he finishes his list of things that he hates, he's going to say the antidote is the covenant, its terms and conditions, and the Torah, which presents it. If you know the Torah, you can't be fooled by the likes of Paul.
No, you're covered.
Yep.
You're protected.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine naming a son Shaul. Question him. Especially considering that Sheol is the realm of dead souls who are questioned and then eternally separated from God, a place of no return, of abandonment and punishment. Worse, after the failures of King Shaul, why would a father name their son after him? But there is the fascinating and unexpected part for all of this. I'd like to reemphasize it. That is that Shaul was good. And being good, obviously, gets a person nowhere with God. You know, how many people say, well, I think I'll be getting to heaven because, you know, I was good.
Hey, look at all the good things I did.
Yeah, I had a good heart.
Mm-hmm.
I was a good person. Well, God's saying good doesn't mean crap. That means anything.
No.
Being right is important. Being good's not. No, it's nothing wrong with being good. But if you're
that doesn't mean you go off and become a murderer.
Yeah, if your claim is being
a big sign says, look at me.
Right.
I mean, you've done nothing until you've agreed with the covenant, you've done what he's asked you to do.
I would never once claim to be good. I'm not a bad person, but I would never say you should follow me because I'm setting a good example. Would never say that. I would never say that I'm good, but I will say that I'm right.
Yeah, well, you've never said follow me either.
Ever. No, being good doesn't get you anywhere with God. Being right does.
Yes.
But that makes sense because good is purely subjective. I mean, people think they do good all the time, but they're really not doing anything worthwhile or good.
Yeah, all the people that go off on a Mormon mission would be considered themselves doing good works, serving others, being good.
Stealing children away from it.
People making a donation to the church think that that's good. No, not from God's point of view. Bad. It promulgates the lie.